The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. As we head into hour three, time change and all, it is a delight to have Brandon Weicker with us. He is the author of several books, Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower, The Shadow War, Iran's Quest for Supremacy, and Biohacked, China's Race to Control Life. You can follow him on Twitter, X, Twix, at We the Brandon. Brandon Weicker, happy Monday. How are you, sir?
Happy Monday. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. There's a lot going on. What's top of mind for you right now? Is it something foreign policy related or domestic policy related?
Well, I've been reading this very wonderfully contrarian book by Robert Vitalis called Oilcraft, mm-hmm. The Myths of Scarcity and Security That Haunt U.S. Energy Policy. It was recommended to me by a friend in the intelligence community who works Middle East policy, and it flies in the face of many of the things that I believe in, but it's very well written, and it's extremely thought-provoking, all about how basically we basically made an idol, a false idol, out of oil in the foreign policy community, and you know, he argues, and I don't necessarily agree, but it's an interesting argument the way he frames it. But he argues that basically we should be looking at oil like any other commodity, and we should not be going to war over oil or seeking to control the sources of oil, to basically let the market decide. And it's just a very interesting argument, especially because he seems to be pretty far to the left, this writer, but it's really interesting the way he goes about it.
So he's thinking oil is the future or fossil fuels?
No, he's just saying that it's part of our lives, and instead of trying to, you know, he doesn't like our foreign policy toward the Middle East in general. He thinks we're too involved. It's sort of, you know, he's definitely not a fan of doing business with the Saudis and things like that. And he's saying that we shouldn't make our foreign policy predicated upon oil. Of course, I think that that is probably a naive viewpoint, but it's an interesting take nonetheless.
It is interesting. One interesting element to it is, if I understand things rightly, those we are competing with, our enemies, let us say, for example, China, they mm-hmm. don't think this way.
No, they're very mercantilistic in their approach to commodities in particular,
right.
Which is why I say I don't necessarily agree with it, but it is an interesting take. And in the book, he's arguing that even when we were sanctioning like Saddam's Iraq, U.S. and Western oil companies were finding workarounds through the U.N., for instance, to get access to the Iraqi oil that was sanctioned. And I think there is some merit to the arguments that, for instance, our sanctions against Russia's oil economy are not really working out as we thought they would.
Right.
In fact, I'm currently writing a piece about how the Russians have won the energy war against the West for thepipeline.com, where I'm an energy security analyst.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's definitely some interesting points that Vitalis makes, but I think it's a conversation we should be having, at least in the foreign policy community, more than we do. But you're absolutely correct. Our enemies are very mercantilistic when it comes to looking at commodities like oil or rare earth minerals. They don't want to leave it to the market. They want to control all the choke points.
For those like this gentleman, Brandon Weicker, that don't like reliance on foreign sources, among other reasons that they have, wouldn't a strong appeaser of their point of view, wouldn't a strong appeasement of their point of view be for us to be security independent like we once were?
Yeah, it's interesting. He argues that we are. And the book came out about 6 months ago.
Okay.
He in his introduction, I just started reading
yep.
it a couple days ago.
Yep.
But his introduction, it's just interesting because, of course, the counterpoint to what he's saying is his argument is that we've actually expanded oil production under Biden. Domestic fracking and whatnot has increased. But he never mentions the fact that the Biden administration is not authorizing new leases for development in the United States and North America. And he also doesn't mention the fact that Biden has increased the regulatory burdens on the domestic fossil fuel industry. But nonetheless, he makes the argument that, you know, as a corrective, we've already been energy independent. He says we get about 18% of our oil from the Middle East. And of course, the counterpoint to that is even if we got 1% of our oil from the Middle East, our enemies are getting most of their oil from the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And so we should try to have a greater role there just to kind of tip the balance in our favor, which of course then he would contend is another example of shoddy thinking. But it's an interesting book. I recommend your audience get it. It's very short. The book is only like 189 pages.
Give us the title and author one more time.
It's called Oilcraft, and one word, O-I-L-C-R-A-F-T, like witchcraft. And it's by Robert Vitalis.
Nice.
V-I-T-A-L-I-S.
Very good. How do you pick a new book to read? You know, we have a literate audience. My audience loves books. I love books.
Yes.
You love books. How do you pick what to read? I assume it's not mostly based on going to the New York Times bestseller list.
Never. No book I've ever read has been recommended by the New York Times bestseller list. Like I said, a friend of mine at DIA, dear friend of mine, we were chatting a while back, and he had mentioned it to me, and I ordered it, and Amazon botched the delivery because it took weeks to get here, but it got here a couple days ago. And so I decided, you know what, it's a short book. It's got an interesting cover that was very eye-appealing, and I know that sounds superficial, but, you know, if the cover of a book is interesting, it's going to make me want to open it and at least read the first couple chapters.
Sure.
So that's generally usually friends, like my friend works the Middle East desk, so he's sort of an expert, and, he recommended that and a couple other books to me. And so friends like that I'll listen to, or if it just pops up in my Amazon books that I might be interested in because the algorithm knows me.
They're pretty good. Yeah. It's actually frightening.
Yeah. It is. It's very creepy, actually. The creepy line has definitely been crossed.
Let's talk about creepy lines. Let's talk about creeps and let's talk about lines. Let's talk about our American president saying to an ally that there is a red line in their fighting.
Let's go farther than that, Seth. We're sending U.S. military forces to build a port for Hamas.
Yeah.
Head-chopping, baby-killing, Iranian-backed, anti-Israel, as well as anti-American Hamas. And the reason that they don't have a port already is because the Israelis had to cut them off. Because in 2010, it turned out they were using their ports in Gaza for illicit weapons transfers and for God knows what else. And so the Israelis had to basically do a blockade and stop that because that was a huge threat to their national security. And now here comes President Biden trying to win over the folks in Dearborn, the Muslim Americans there, coming in there and saying, we're sending U.S. Army Corps of Engineers into a very unsafe area to build a port for Hamas. And now you have the spokesperson for the Pentagon pleading with Hamas, please don't take any shots at our troops while they're building you this port.
I think he said if you care about human life, you'll let this go forward.
Right. Yeah. Right. Which, of course, if you know what happened on October 7th, I don't know how you can say this organization cares about human life. And one other thing, Seth, I don't mean to filibuster one other thing here is Netanyahu has been very clear that he has his own red line.
Mm-hmm.
And what is to stop Netanyahu from saying this is a direct threat to the safety of my troops fighting in Gaza, and it's a direct threat. This port is a direct threat to my national security. What's to stop him then from saying, America, if you're going to be building my enemies their infrastructure to continue to do war upon us, we're going to have to do something to stop the construction of this port you know, and now you have a situation where there could be a standoff.
Yeah, let me pause on that, because I want to talk to you philosophically about some of this and the nature of war and the way social media has kind of changed terms of debate, or at least thinking. Brandon Weichert is my guest. He can be followed on Twitter, X, Twix, at We the Brandon, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, brought to you by the veteran-owned Midas Gold Group, your trusted source for precious metals. Brandon Weichert is our guest. He is the author of several books, including The Shadow War, Iran's Quest for Supremacy. Has a new book on the Ukraine-Russia War coming out a little bit later this year. We await that impatiently, but we await it nonetheless. Okay, Brandon, so we're talking about this, I don't know, what do you call it, this temporary or this floating humanitarian port that I think...
I call it an insult to our allies and to reason.
Well, yeah, so I think the natural inclination on that point, the natural inclination is to say, well, why wouldn't you want to have humanitarian aid going in to a place where obviously there is a lot of hunger, in fact, maybe even perhaps starvation? And I have a lot to say about that, but I'll throw the first question to you.
Well, I think the answer comes back to what Sherman said to the mayor of Atlanta as he was lighting the city on fire in the Civil War. War is brutal, war is hell.
Mm-hmm.
Forgive me, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on the
air.
You are,
as long as you capitalize it, because it's a proper noun.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's the quote.
Okay.
And, you know, Sherman did not take any joy in burning the South, but he did it because he believed it would end the war, that by being more brutal and vicious in that moment than the South ever could be, that it would force a surrender. And, of course, it did. And this was the same logic, by the way, behind dropping the nukes on Japan. And again, it worked. It is not pretty. War is not pretty. We should not seek it out. But the Israelis, in their defense, were not seeking out a war. I understand that, you know, people defending Hamas are bringing up settlers and they're bringing up all this ancillary stuff about the Israelis have done over the last 50 years. But what happened on October 7th was not provoked by any kind of action by the Israelis. The only thing that provoked it was 3 weeks before the attacks on October 7th, Netanyahu went to the UN and announced the new Middle East was being born, that he had been finalizing the deal that Trump had begun while in office, bringing security interests of Israel and aligning it together with the Saudis. And that had to be stopped by the Iranians. The Iranians could not let that alliance come together, and lo and behold, 3 weeks later, there you have, 2 weeks later, there you have the Iran-backed Hamas doing this horrific attack. The whole thing was designed to prevent the alliance from coming to fruition, because the Saudis, they now are watching as Israel has to retaliate against Arabs, of which many Saudis are sympathetic toward, and so now the alliance is at least on ice for now. And this was the Iranian intention. And so all these idiots running around saying that the Israelis precipitated it, the Israelis were not doing anything. In fact, the Israelis for 50-plus years have traded land for peace, and the only thing they've ever gotten was more war and enmity from their neighbors.
See, that is the ineluctable conclusion that truly is at the heart of this, that if you want to, and my gosh, plenty of people have, justified or whitewashed the October 7th attack. You've seen both. You've seen whitewashing, but you've seen justifications almost nightly on Piers Morgan from professors, even Americans like Norman Finkelstein, et cetera.
My old DePaul professor.
But,
yes.
Right, for them, that's right, yes. That's right. Your old DePaul. The point is, if there is to be a rationalization, a sanitization, a justification for, you know, well, you have to understand these people have been under such duress. You have to understand that it's been an open air, prison, any number of these things that are said. The only real justification is what you said, which is that Israel exists. You have to ineluctably come to the conclusion that if you want October 7th not to happen, you have to have no Israel.
Well, and that's in the Hamas charter.
Yes.
The original Hamas charter, the first point, it's a four-point charter. The first point is the destruction of Israel. Okay? And so your audience needs to understand, for those who might, and there's a lot on the right that are feeling sympathetic for whatever bizarre reason for Hamas. Hamas, first of all, is not representative of their people. They represent the Iranian interests. That's the first point. The second point is Hamas is not interested in peace under any circumstance. They are interested in a ceasefire to buy time so they can basically rearm and reequip and continue the holy war against Israel, the holy war being to destroy Israel forever. That is what Israel is up against. And they have had multiple examples in recent history of trying to do deals with, I mean, the Netanyahu government was paying Hamas to basically not attack Israel so that Israeli forces could focus on Hezbollah to the north. And Hamas betrayed that deal, and it turns out they've been planning this attack for, you know, many weeks and months before the attack took place, which means that that even the mowing the lawn, as they call it, the mowing the lawn strategy that Netanyahu was employing was actually being taken advantage of by Hamas. So ultimately, the Hamas is not interested. They are not. They do not care about doing a deal with Israel. Or, you know, they're not the victims here at all. They are the bully. They are the attacker. They must be destroyed. And Israel must inflict so much damage on Gaza that it basically disabuses Hamas of its notions that it can take Israel on.
So when you see these pictures of bombed out areas of Gaza, I think the one floating around now, right, most prominently is in Khan Yunis. Certain heartstrings are tugged. I mean, you can't look at these things and be cold to it, but you have to understand who's pulling those heartstrings and what the purpose of it is,
exactly.
Don't you? I mean, in a certain sense, we had an economic, yeah. Not in a certain sense, in a very historical sense, we had an economic boycott against Germany in World War II. We did our best to blockade goods and services going in to Germany. It seems an odd thing for an allied government to try and sustain an enemy government in the time of war.
We're not an ally under Biden of Israel, okay. Which is why I said before the break, I'm very worried that Netanyahu is going to feel like he's going to have to do something to stop the construction of this port. I mean, he's not going to have a choice at some point because our government is putting U.S. troops in the middle of a religious and ethnic blood feud, just like they did in Ukraine. We have no business being in the middle of it. We have for 60 or 70 years supported Israel. And now suddenly we're reversing course and supporting the head choppers of Hamas, the head choppers who want to kill Americans as much as they want to kill Israelis. And so there's absolutely no upside to what Biden is doing. And it's only alienating further our regional partners in a region that we frankly, and this is where I disagree with the book that we were talking about earlier, that we frankly have a vital role to play in. And obviously we can't be patrolling the streets of the Middle East, but we need to have willing partners who will do that for us to prevent other powers like Russia, China, from moving in on this resource-rich area.
Brandon Weikert is my guest. Pause it right there, Brandon. We'll pick up on that. We come right back. Brandon Weikert is my guest. Follow him on Twitter, X, at WeTheBrandon. You're writing for the National Interest now, among other places, right, Brandon?
That is my new home, and I'm loving it. It is probably the best employer I've ever had. They're
oh, wonderful.
Very good to me.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Very
yeah,
respected.
I'm on, according to my detractors, I'm on a, quote, jihad against the aircraft carrier.
Oh, talk to me about that. What does that mean?
Well, I've been I don't pick the articles, by the way. The editors ask me to if I can, you know, comment on whatever. And they, for some reason, have fixated for me on naval issues, which is fine. I think it's very interesting. And I know a lot about the Navy. And so they have me right now writing on what's known as anti-access area denial, A2AD. Our enemies have developed weapon systems that can basically so badly threaten U.S. Navy warships, surface warships, as to make them basically useless, because if we were to deploy them into these A2AD covered areas like the South China Sea or the Taiwan Strait, surely our warships would be sunk before they could do much damage to the enemy, particularly our aircraft carriers. So what I've been writing since starting at the National Interest is I've been advising the Navy they need to divorce themselves from their love affair with the aircraft carrier and start looking at submarines, start trying to actually get their own hypersonic missile technologies going, and they need to start building up significant amounts of their automated drone weapon systems so that we can destroy those A2AD systems and then potentially then bring in our more conventional surface warship fleet. But as it stands, our fleet, if it's deployed against these massive Chinese missiles and hypersonic kill vehicles, the carrier killers, our warships are basically going to be sunk almost in the first engagement or be so badly damaged that they're going to be combat ineffective.
Yeah. Well, why would anyone disagree with your position on this?
Well, in Washington, D.C., yeah. the national interest is very well read,
yep.
And highly regarded.
I was reading it in college. I remember it well. Yeah.
Yes. So it's highly regarded in the halls of power.
Yep.
And there is the captains of conventional wisdom who run our country, particularly defense contractor types,
yeah.
who want us to be spending tens of billions of dollars on these legacy systems, even though these systems are no longer really that relevant to the current threat environment. And so, you know, here I come from Southwest Florida, mm-hmm. micturating on the fire hydrant, and they don't like it.
It really ties the room together, you know, Brandon.
It really does. It really does. And you know what? It tickles me when I get these hate mail from all these people who are telling me that, you know, the aircraft carrier is infallible. I hate to break it to you, but the aircraft carrier, the Air Force's F-35, these trillions and billions of dollars that we've spent, all of these systems are the definition of diminished return.
Yeah.
And rather than focus on new and innovative and maybe more cost-effective ways at countering our enemies, we just keep doubling down because the defense contractors in D.C. are so connected with Congress that they can get away with this. And so we really need to shake things up. And I'm hoping that Trump, if he can win, I'm hoping that he can. One of the things he can do is acquisitions reform.
Good. Good. While we're right there, by the way, on China, over the weekend, for nerds like us who follow these things, something interesting kind of arose that I noticed, which was a congeree of conservatives, including Donald Trump, including Vivek Ramaswamy, and including Kellyanne Conway, are opposing going after and shutting down TikTok. I was a little bit surprised by this, to say the least, Brandon. I don't know where you were on this.
It makes perfect sense because Donald Trump is listening to certain people, and you listed some of them, who are representing TikTok's interests in the United States. And they're lobbying.
You mean on the payroll?
I'm not going to identify who, but you listed a few people,
yeah,
one
uh-huh.
of which is most certainly on the payroll
okay,
now.
Okay, okay.
And I'm not at liberty to say, but there are others as
sure.
well that he listens to, and they are lobbying actively.
Well, I got to tell you a story about this when we come right back, if you're
okay.
good for another segment. This was our short one.
Absolutely.
I want to tell you about the strength of the Chinese Communist Party's lobby in Washington. Brandon Weikert, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, brought to you in part by the veteran-owned Midas Gold Group, your trusted source for precious metals. Brandon Weikert, our guest, W-E-I-C-H-E-R-T. There used to be a sinologist of pretty good repute. I think he's been quiet for a while, and I don't mean any disrespect if I'm just wrong about that, but his name just hasn't crossed my transom in a while. Professor at University of Pennsylvania, Arthur Waldron,
yeah.
And was writing some pretty good stuff on China, probably before it was popular, had a piece in Commentary magazine in the early 2000s. And
yeah.
Commentary is a hell of an output. It's, it's made a lot of careers. It's made some controversial essays. And the editor told me he never got more pushback on a piece, if, with all their controversial writings on race and you name it,
right,
than a piece Arthur Waldron did condemning, or at least raising the alarm of China. And this was in the 2000s. Yeah. They are a powerful lobby. So when I'm seeing, you know, the dangers of TikTok, I think I have it right that 60% of American teens use it as a search engine. Never mind what adults are doing with it.
Right.
And you see that the CCP is working so very damn hard to keep it operating here. That should kind of be a clue.
In fact, in my Long Liberty piece from a year ago, I think it's called Now is the Time to Act or something. I can't remember now. But I took social media generally to task.
Yeah.
But I specifically at the end, the last third is ripping TikTok.
Yeah.
And showing how TikTok is reprogramming the neuronal pathways of teenagers who use it.
Right.
Now, in China, they regulate TikTok. It can only be used for patriotic and educational.
Yeah, like math and science stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That is not the case here in the United States, as anybody with a teenager knows.
Mike Gallagher, the congressman, said the Chinese version, Douyin, gives the kids spinach. It gives Americans digital fentanyl.
That's right. And so you have to, and I've been critical of Trump, and I've tried to not be critical anymore because he's obviously our only hope. But every Trump voter should be very worried about his complete 180 on TikTok. This was a guy, as president, who was one of the leading proponents of canceling TikTok's presence here in the United States. I mean, Trump gave speeches as president up until 2019 when he would be talking openly about getting rid of TikTok and as part of his program of basically de-CCPing the United States.
Yeah.
And now suddenly he's reversing course. And the only thing I can think of is somebody sat him down that he listens to and is influencing him, because that individual who's influencing him is on the payroll of this organization that is representing TikTok to Congress. Furthermore, I also think there are certain Mar-a-Lago advisors who are telling the president that, hey, if you want to get any of the youth vote, you can't go after TikTok. And we all know that Donald Trump lives by the polls, for better or worse.
Yeah.
And so he's looking at that as well. It's one of the reasons he's also completely reversed course on abortion.
Mm-hmm.
He's worried about losing votes. But what the man needs to understand is he's not going to win in a landslide election. We're never going to have a landslide election again in this country, no matter what a poll tells you. It's going to be a tight election, because our country is very split, and it's going to really come down to what's going on in the country between August and October. That's what's going to determine the election. And so he needs to focus on the 5 or 6 or 7 swing states where he can really do a lot of damage to Biden, and stop trying to abandon all of his previous very good stances like banning TikTok, because he thinks he might get a few points from the youth. It's not going to happen, and he really needs to look at the people he's listening to and figure out who they're being paid for to say these things.
One of the things that he or Vivek, and I think including Elon Musk, if I'm not mistaken, was saying over the weekend is if you get rid of TikTok, you make Facebook stronger, and Facebook is an enemy of you know, to them, Facebook is an enemy too. Right, yeah.
That too, absolutely. Well, I mean, I say this as somebody who, because I have to sell books, I'm required to be on social media.
Sure.
Had my publisher not made that part of our deal, I was in the process of deactivating all of my social media accounts. I hate social media.
Yep.
And I will tell you that it's not just CCP, propaganda,
right,
but the social media, all of these social media platforms rewire the human brain.
Yes, sure.
Okay, that's not good. Like drugs do, that's not good.
No, it isn't. And you know, there have been people, professors like Jonathan Haidt at NYU and others, who have been able to track the youth mental health crisis with the increased development and increased use of social media by our youth. Yeah,
absolutely. It's a self-induced psychological pandemic.
That's a nicely put phrase.
A self-induced psychological pandemic.
I'm writing that right down. I'm writing that down. Self-induced.
Well, you know, I am a professional writer, so I have my moments.
You have more than a few months. Self-induced psychological
pandemic.
We have a bunch of them. We have a bunch of them going on right now, and
mostly brought to us by the left.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking that very thing. They want us in frenzy. It seems to me,
of course.
They want us unsettled. You know, this is how you agitate. This is how you revolutionize, and this is how you distract. Isn't that kind of the moment we're in? We've never been more distracted. We've never been more frenzied than we are now.
In my opinion, America today looks eerily like Russia in 1917.
Right, okay.
Or interwar Germany, when you had basically communists and fascists duking it out in the streets. I mean, we are one step away from that. That is a revolutionary moment. We had it in 2020. Something's going to happen again soon going into this election because I think that our elite are very worried that if left to his own devices, Trump would win over Biden. And that is, of course, a very scary prospect for the elite, because a second Trump term basically cuts them out of the power and they can't have that. So there's going to be something going on soon domestically that's going to cause all kinds of chaos that could potentially disrupt the election to such a point that the Democrats are able to stay in power by default. It's a very scary moment for our country.
When you come on next week, let's you and I postulate what those things could be and compare
Certainly.
And contrast it to how COVID operated in America in 2020. Could we do that next
Certainly.
Week?
Let's
do
Absolutely.
That. Would be fun. That would
be
a fun exercise.
Attack, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. All right, Brandon Weikert. Well, thanks for always saving your Mondays for us. We love having you.
Yeah.
And we're coming out to Arizona. We're going to try and get you in studio.
I'd love that.
All right, brother. Yes. We'll be in touch. Thank you. Stay well.
Thank you.
Brandon Weikert. I'll be right back. Portions of this show brought to you by our good friends at Y Refi. They have a secure investment in a collateralized portfolio where you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return, and it's not correlated to the stock market or the Federal Reserve. With Y Refi, you're in control. You can turn your income on or off. You can compound it, whatever you like. With Y Refi, there are absolutely no fees. With Y Refi, there is no attack on principal if you ever need your money back. And of course, you get a monthly statement with no surprises. Check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then refy.com, or give them a call at 888-YREFI-20. For Congressman Mike Gallagher wrote about TikTok. We know for a fact that the CCP, that's the Chinese Communist Party, uses TikTok to push its propaganda and censor views that diverge from the party line. Reports have confirmed that TikTok spies on journalists who write negative stories about TikTok. Via TikTok, Chinese state media push divisive information about U.S. politicians ahead of midterm elections. And numerous reports have found TikTok censoring and suppressing content about Xinjiang, Tibet, Tiananmen Square, and other issues sensitive to the Chinese Communist Party. Xinjiang is the province where the Uyghurs are being immiserated. TikTok has also suppressed content about LGBTQ issues and temporarily blocked a teenage American Muslim activist who criticized the CCP's treatment of Uyghur Muslims. I would like to get rid of it. Until we do, I just want to keep mentioning it to parents. When you get your children their smartphones or their laptops, there's a lot of things you can do to make those safe experiences. Nothing more important than ensuring TikTok is not one of their apps or one of their interfaces. All right, Mr. Bill, thank you for all your help today. Folks, until tomorrow, God bless you all. I am Seth Leibson, and class is dismissed.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.